evening, I'm convening this meeting of the Joint Committee on Student Success Subcommittee on Revenue. This is February 5th. We are having an informational meeting to help establish, we're going to do some framework, work on framework, what it is we're working toward, what some guiding principles ought to be. Let's just all be on the same page with how we're going to manage our conversations about our task and the topic of revenue. Mr. Alanak.
Good evening, Madam Chair, members of the committee. In OLIS for this evening, there are three items, two handouts that I'm going to walk through, and then a study that's just up for the committee's pleasure reading later on. The first document I wanted to touch on is the Principles and Mechanics document. And following up on what you just said, Madam Chair, it starts off with the guiding principles. Now, most of these, the first five, actually, were in the document last Tuesday that was discussed. One member noted that it didn't mention that those guiding principles did not mention a progressive tax structure. So the principles, I've added that to the group just for the committee to discuss or review. Just I don't know if you want to go into any more detail now or just the fact that I added that there, letting the committee know.
Thank you. And pardon me while I get my materials up on the screen. Thank you for providing that to us with the additional point. My hope is that this subcommittee can adopt some language that we agree to, because I suspect that at the point where we come up with a recommendation to the full joint committee, we might have some language at the beginning about we were assigned with this task and this is what we're looking for. So is there any discussion from committee members on the points that are in this? Yes.
Sorry, I was just pointing.
Senator Bentz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I guess my question is, you're asking, are there remarks, discussion, thoughts regarding the guiding principles?
That's right. Thank you.
And I might suggest that just as Chris suggested today, the progressive concept could be added. I'm going to guess that we would be adding to these principles as we proceed. In other words, nothing's going to be locked in. As they pop into our heads, we can blurt out, oh, yes, that should be a principle. So I will blurt one out right now. I think that principle should be that any tax has to take into account already existing tax burden. So you could kind of read that in here under balanced treatment across business structures, but I think it should be called out. Because if we, can only do so much, and without knowing what we're already doing in whatever space we're talking about, we would, I'm sure, prompt a whole bunch of questions. Should we show up with a recommendation, and someone might say, "Well, wait a minute, that doesn't seem to fit," or "Where does it fit?" So anyway, that's my suggestion.
Yes.
For the moment.
Well, to follow in on that, that actually kind of dovetails into an issue I had. I don't know how you'd frame this, but right now, under the national ratings, we're dead last on, or next to last on corporate taxes. And so I would like to see us more in the middle of the pack nationally. And if we stay toward the bottom, that's one issue. If we end up number one in the nation, that's probably not somewhere we want to be. But I think maybe just to have an objective to be aware of where we stand nationally on the tax burden under our various alternatives. And that kind of dovetails into what you're talking about.
Thank you. I'm going to jump in here. At our last meeting, one of the things that I mentioned is while these, I understand why they're categorized as principles, there were other things that I thought we should always be looking out for and recognize we're watching for this, that, and the other thing. And I, at that meeting, mentioned several things I had heard from each of you and some other things I had noted as we were hearing the presentations. And I wondered if we might distinguish principles for what we're aiming for as compared to, and we are also taking into consideration these things. For example, as Senator Burdick just pointed out, the tax burden relative to other states and the national average. And Senator Bentz had pointed out something that I think might be more like we need to always take into consideration the total tax burden. It's not necessarily a principle of what we're aiming for, but we've always got to be looking at it. Does that make sense? And some of the other considerations that I had mentioned were, and again, some of this was based on your comments as well as my own observations, taking into account, just making sure we recognize that we've looked at pyramiding, ease of filing, relationship with federal tax law, transparency, tax avoidance, number of exceptions or special treatment and loopholes, a lot versus a little, differences between industry sectors, and does everyone participate? That we're just kind of always looking at the interplay of these different kinds of things. Sometimes we might find that some of them are mutually exclusive, like simplicity and ease of filing doesn't fit in well with certain other things that we might do to accommodate a special situation if we found that was important to do. But I think you're calling out some important things that we and the committee and the public should know we're always watching out for. Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I agree, and I would actually argue that I think we could probably, so when we talked about this last week, I think I said to you briefly, I always find I'm a visual person, and I always judge a chart or a presentation based on how easily I can look at it and figure out what it is it's trying to tell me. That's a basic principle, I think, of being able to convey information in that way. And one of the ways that I kind of foresee us reviewing this with this premise that we're going to go through a couple different options and review them and try to come up with a recommendation, I have this vision in my head of kind of a, like principles and each different kind of ways and either just check marks, yes or no, or variations among them. And I think we'd probably do well to have kind of principles and considerations that are slightly different, that get to that slight difference in what you're talking about. I don't know that ease of filing is a principle, but it's certainly a consideration. I don't know that how does this interact with other taxes that were already, you know, how does this fit into the overall taxing scheme? It's not really a principle, but it certainly is a consideration that would take into account differences between proposals. So I feel like I think that makes a lot of sense, and I think we could probably come up and like Senator Bentz said, you know, we could start with a chunk now and we may, I wouldn't blurt it out, I think. Maybe Senator Bentz is more of a blurter. But I think indeed as we go through this, I think we're probably pretty set on the principles, but I think we're likely to come up with more considerations as we review the different proposals. So the point of that long rambling anecdote would be, I agree with you, and I think that there are those are two different chunks of things, and I don't want us to get too caught up in the language, but I think there's room for us to use both of those in our analysis as we go forward.
Do you have something to blurt?
Yes, for me to blurt anything out. Well, your remarks remind me of Groucho Marx's quote, which was, I'm a man of principles, and if you don't like him, I have others. And so I'm guessing we could discuss for a while whether these are principles or things to be taken into account, and that's probably up to each of us. I would like to talk about the first one, the revenue source dedicated. That word dedicated is a great interest to me. We currently have what? We have ODOT's got a dedicated funding source. Do we have a dedicated funding source for schools, property taxes, for example?
I
would say the state doesn't.
Not in that sense. I mean, school districts are allowed to impose property taxes. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's kind of a different take on that as opposed to a general run revenue source that goes to them, but they get to impose those taxes. So those districts themselves, the K-12 and community colleges and the ESDs.
But not at the state.
There are portions of other revenue sources that are dedicated to education. Mm-hmm. Lottery, for example.
Mm. Right, there are different pieces, but in terms of a single revenue, I guess it depends on how you look at it, in terms of a single revenue stream going to those.
So, if I may, Madam Chair, the concept here is that whatever emerges as a recommendation from this committee is going to be dedicated to funding, quote, a successful school system, end quote. That's the concept. Is that what that means? So whatever we do is not going to be raising money in general. It's going to be saying, and this shall go to schools.
Correct.
That's the concept.
That's my understanding, yes.
The practical way that we'll do is this money will fund the top priorities from the Student Success Committee. Those haven't been set yet, but there's a long list of them. We can't do all of them, but whether it's a longer school year or a mental health issue, that's what this will pay for.
And I'm sure, so the idea is, though, this is dedicated to that purpose. It's not going to be just more money to dump into the general fund. This is earmarked for those purposes permanently until changed by this legislature 6 months later. Is that correct? I believe up to 6 months later.
Almost will probably be adjourned those 6 months later. But I get your meaning.
Okay, dedicated in quotes.
Mm-hmm. No, I don't think they're in quotes. I think it's a full stop dedicated. But that is the premise, is this is not money that's going to the general fund. This is a dedicated source going with a dedicated destination.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
So we want it in the Constitution then? Because then it would be dedicated. Otherwise, it's good for 6 months until we meet again.
Correct. In theory, perhaps?
No, not in theory, in reality. But I just want us to talk about what dedicated means to each of us.
Okay.
Since I didn't write it, I'm asking you, so whoever put it here can share with me what they were thinking.
I can share with you that is my intent and purpose, and the entire intent of the work we've been doing for the last year is come up with. We have talked about the need is to have a dedicated source that goes to specifically to education, not to the general fund, not to whatever, in the same way that the transportation bill that we did in 2017 had dedicated revenue that went to a dedicated list of projects and items.
It's constitutional.
No.
No.
The road fund is. The highway fund is,
sure,
dedicated to the roads.
Right. But the rest of the things in that package are not constitutional.
Okay, well, forgive me for not separating those out. I'm talking about the ones that are so dedicated. And that's what I'm asking you here, is that's not the case unless you put it in the Constitution.
No, yes and no. The political process, just using the marijuana changes that we made as an example, the statutory marijuana measure dedicated it to a certain mix of things, the school fund, the drug and alcohol treatment, et cetera, et cetera. An attempt was made to change those dedications. And the building was swarmed with people who said, nope, you can't do that. The political process itself, if you try to change the dedication of a funding source, you're right, it's not as ironclad as the Constitution, but it's a trade-off, because as we go down the road, it may be that other priorities have to get in line in front of it, but we're not operating in a vacuum. There are strong stakeholder groups who will be very attached to these areas of dedication. So I'm assured by that, that it will be flexible, but it's not going to be overturned because of the politics of what we do.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
So I enjoy your definition and discussion of it. I'm going to move on to, not to be lawyer-esque about it, but apparently this is dedicated to only successful school systems.
How do you read that?
Because that's what it says, funding a successful school system. So I'm sure what you really meant to say was, we want to put this money toward a system that, because of the funding amount, is more likely to be successful.
Right.
You're not limiting it to just successful systems, or we might be in big trouble.
I think, Senator, what you're pointing out is we could certainly do some wordsmithing here to clarify the intent.
Actually, I'm calling out the subjectivity of the word successful.
Indeed.
And that, so,
yes.
But I'm happy to move on.
Well, but he makes a good point. I mean, we're trying to make them successful, but yeah. You don't like that word?
There is undoubtedly language in the mission of the Joint Committee on Student Success that would guide us in how to reword this first principle. I'd like us to take a look at that.
The senators ask if I don't like that word. That's not the case. I love the word successful, and I hope that our school systems are all ultimately successful. What I'm trying to say is, when we start talking about dedicating funding to a, quote, successful system, let's make sure we all know what we're talking about. Because what I think we're really saying is, we think that it's going to take more money to make our system successful.
Correct.
Isn't that what we're really saying?
Yeah.
And when we say, when I say the word successful is subjective, it certainly is, because each one of our concepts of what that means is going to be entirely different.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
And I would also add that in the conversations that we have had, again, about the structure of this, in addition to what we need to do is to establish a revenue source that it does not go to the general fund, that is dedicated to the school system, and that we use for, I use Measure 98 as my shorthand in that model of using for things that we know work and that will increase the success of those school systems.
I think this also calls into question the use of the word system. Many people would immediately jump to the assumption that we're talking about individual school systems, and we have how many school districts around the state. This may be reworded in a way that we're talking about a system of education, a system in a more using the word in a more generic way and not referring to specific individual school systems. So let's take a look at the way it's worded. But I think there's a general understanding of what we think this is about, because that is in our mission as a subcommittee that we got from the big committee.
And I think that, Senator, with all due respect, I think that Senator, sorry, I'm blanking, Senator Cliff, I should not call him that, Senator Bence is pointing out that indeed much of this wording is subjective and we all might have a different idea about what it means. And to me, that does not take away from the fact that it is a guiding principle. Even if we all have a slightly different idea of what it means, I would argue that that is, again, we are in an imperfect system and we are trying to establish a baseline of agreement about what our goals are here. And yes, I agree that we're all gonna there's gonna be some subjective readings of that, and that doesn't take away from the fact that we still need to have some guiding principles, and that those are the guiding principles that are posited or proposed.
What about the rest of the points in the guiding principles? I'd like to get to a point where the members of this subcommittee felt comfortable leaving these in the state they are now, knowing that there's going to be some wordsmithing and there may be some more blurting out in subsequent meetings of, oh, we've just realized or recognized that there's another principle that we seem to be applying as we're discussing what solutions we're considering. So language may be changed, some of it removed, or something added at subsequent meetings. Is that all right? So this is it for now, but it doesn't mean that the language is permanent and can't be changed. It's there until we finish doing our work, and we can keep monkeying with it. Let's move on to the next part of the material that you've prepared for us.
Okay. The next item on that chart is under basic mechanics. There's a bar chart here. As you may recall, last week, there was a kind of an area chart that showed the gradation from a gross receipts tax down to an income tax. So this is a more discrete version of that, where we just have four tax bases, but the concept is generally the same. We have a tax base and a tax rate needed to raise a given amount of money. So it really boils that down to that simple arithmetic, where under the gross receipts tax, we have about a tax base of $300 billion. And that is a ballpark number for gross receipts, some of the estimates that we're using when we're looking at other states and what that might mean for Oregon, $300 billion tax base. And so a tax rate of 0.33% gets to $1 billion annually. And then as we move down to toward an income tax, so we get into an area where I've used the labels VAT A and VAT B, value added tax A and value added tax B, just in a generic sense, where that tax base is, A is about $175 billion and B is $125 billion. Those are just picked out of thin air because there are a lot of details in how you modify a gross receipts tax to get down to a VAT. And under either one of those, if the tax base is $175 billion, the tax rate needed to get to $1 billion annually is 0.57%, and then that rate increases to 0.8%. If that VAT is a slightly different VAT with a smaller base, maybe there's some exemptions or other subtractions. And then at the far right of that, we get to the income tax, where we have a tax base of around $8.5 or $9 billion, and that's taken from the corporate income tax. And this is largely illustrative here. And to get to there, to get to $1 billion, it would be an additional 11.6%. And so if we're talking about the corporate tax rate, it would just be on top of that. It's an additional tax rate. So these aren't revenue impact numbers per se, because we've gone from new taxes where we don't have an existing tax. So the conversation is a little cleaner then, in the sense that we're not modifying a tax. If we get down to an income tax, then that's one that we have. And so there's a difference between, we get to this kind of marginal concept where we have an existing rate of 7.6. So to raise money would be a rate on top of that. And so this is just a different version of that chart, breaking it out into four discrete tax bases. And then the table below this is another way to view that same concept. And tax rates needed to raise $1 billion a year, just keeping that in mind. And here we have a different mix of policies. We have four policies. The first one is a gross receipts tax. And then the second is a business activity tax, or kind of a VAT-ish tax. And then we get to our existing corporate income tax and then the corporate minimum tax. So the top two would be a new tax, and the bottom two there would be changes to the existing tax. And so if you read down, if we're just looking at only that policy change of a gross receipts tax, we see that 0.33% again. And under the business activity tax, the rate here is 0.44. It's just a slightly different tax base. I was trying not to line things up too much, because there are so many policy decisions in getting to a modified gross receipts tax. And then for the bottom two, to modify the corporate income tax to raise $1 billion a year, we would need a corporate tax rate of about 20%. Now I'm getting to numbers where I tied to the current law forecast. So conceptually, that 20% is roughly equivalent to the 11.76% in the above chart plus the current law rate of 7.6. And then the last item there is changing the corporate minimum tax, which is 12 flat dollar amounts to a rate of 0.7%. And so that's, from some one perspective, that's kind of a starting point of how you could get to $1 billion. And then if you read the table to the right, you're adding in additional policy changes. So that second column, the impact with PIT, personal income tax reductions, of $500 million. So if the goal is still to raise $1 billion, and there are personal income tax cuts of $500 million, then you need to raise more from the initial base. So that gross receipts tax, that rate goes from 0.33 to 0.41. So a way of viewing that is that increased rate of 0.08 percentage points buys you or pays for the $500 million personal income tax cut. And then similarly with the business tax version that I have there, it would go from 0.44% to 0.56%. And then the corporate income tax rate would have to go from about 20% to 23.5%. And the corporate minimum tax would go from 0.7% to 0.82%. And then if we go to the third column, now we're talking about additional, more, as we read to the right, we're getting to more changes to the tax system. So that third column is the new tax and the elimination of the corporate income tax. So the gross receipts tax of 0.53% gets you a net $1 billion for a year, but that offsets the elimination of the corporate income tax. And then that fourth column is the elimination of the corporate income tax and those personal income tax reductions. And so the sense here is just this interplay between tax base and the rates needed to get to a targeted dollar amount. And the dollar amounts here are just $1 billion per year, so they can be scaled. So there are different ways to look at this concept.
Can I ask a question?
So, yes.
Let's have some discussion. Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Chris, I may have just dropped off of my attention for a second, but in translating from the base mechanics box down to the tax rates box, the gross receipts number kind of tracks right down from 0.33 to 0.33, but the business activity is 0.44 in the first box, even though your two VAT examples were 0.57 and 0.80. Did you explain that and I missed it? I fear you did.
Well, I tried.
So would you mind explaining that again?
Once we get into a business activity, once we step away from the extremes, if you will, of a gross receipts tax and an income tax, there's a lot of stuff there in the middle.
Gotcha.
And so I'm trying to convey that those options exist. So we have, that's why there are two VATs and generically named VAT A and VAT B. And here it's a business.
And to just kind of broadly represent a couple different ways of the zillions.
Right,
that
they're,
you
they're
do
modified
it.
Gross receipts tax. You can subtract various things from a gross receipts tax.
Okay.
So basically the VAT is included in the business activities tax?
It's a different label for the same kind of tax.
So I guess really what I'm trying to get to is in the base mechanics box, you had higher rates and you used a lower rate in the business activity tax box down below. Right? Or am I misreading
that? Yes,
that
wasn't necessarily by design.
Okay.
That it just happened to be a lower rate.
Gotcha.
I mean, there are so many policy decisions at getting at that base.
Okay. Thank you.
And then the boxes are left empty because it's corporate tax to corporate tax.
You're not going to eliminate the corporate tax if you're raising the rate on the corporate tax.
Right. Got it.
More discussion. This is this is a starting point for conversation. There's a lot of things that relate to each other that we could add or subtract, and what what are we looking for? Do you want some general discussion now of options? Okay. Senator Haas, Mr. Co-Chair.
Well, you know, I am not wedded to any one of these, even on this chart. But a gross receipts tax style does a couple of things. It casts a wider net to begin with of businesses that don't have nexus in this state. Sometimes they're called flyover businesses and have really no relationship with Oregon other than they sell their stuff to Oregonians. And this captures companies that are not paying taxes in Oregon now. And this was explained to me by someone in Nevada several years ago who said, you know, you have Nike up there, right? Yes, and Nike doesn't pay a tax in Nevada, but after we passed our commerce tax, which is what they called their gross receipts tax, they said now Nike pays 0.33% of a sale every time it sells sneakers in Las Vegas or Reno. And they have outlet stores and all that down there, just like we do up here. And that is the example of flyover companies that don't have nexus in a state but are now paying into the state tax. And he said every time Nike pays that tax, it lightens the load for our businesses in Nevada and it helps fund our services. So that is one of the arguments of the gross receipts tax, and I could argue against or for, but that's one of the merits of a gross receipts style tax as opposed to other forms of business taxes.
What about the simplicity piece?
Well, Ohio's famous Ohio tax is a half pinch. And we used to parade it around, I think in 2017, here's their form, and it was pretty simple. Now, they did away with that form and it's online. And that state, the bigger corporations that we have here in Oregon who pay taxes in all 50 states find that feature pretty attractive, at least in the simplicity.
One of the things I recall from our discussion a few days ago, the value-added tax, there was conversation about one interpretation would be it might discourage creating jobs. Could you comment on that? Briefly?
With respect to the value-added tax?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So at a fundamental or simple perspective, the gross receipts tax is all of the business receipts. And then we can modify that to get to something like a value-added. So a pure value-added tax is a tax on labor and goods and mm-hmm. It's the value added to the business. So one way we can get there is what's known as a subtraction method, where you take gross receipts and you subtract the cost of goods sold. And then you can get to a value added approach. And part of what you're then taxing is payroll. And I think that's where that concept mm-hmm. came from, is that if you're reducing the tax base from, you know, the $300 billion down to some smaller amount, then part of what's left in that base is the compensation paid to labor, as opposed to a modified gross receipts tax that, say, starts with that $300 billion and then subtracts labor. And then that gets taken out of that tax base. And you saw a state, I believe it was Texas, where it had a combination. They had ultimately, I think, four different calculations where you can subtract the cost of goods sold or you could subtract labor. And I think that's where some of those concepts came up about, well, what's left in that tax base? As you go from the $300 billion and you remove certain costs from that base, what's left in the base? Because then effectively that's what is being taxed. It's a little similar to the single sales factor on the corporation income tax that the legislature debated several years ago.
Thank you. Senator Hass.
Yes, I don't think that version, I think New Hampshire does this. It doesn't discourage job creation. It's just not one of the things you can deduct to get it to subtract out of your tax base. And so I don't think, I think it might be a stretch to say it discourages job creation.
Thank you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So another, I'm just intrigued because having been schooled in this committee under the mantra of Paul Warner's, the best tax is the lowest and the most broadly applied. It's the only economic theory that I can recite, not that I'm sure what the name is. I'm actually quite struck by the corporate minimum and how what is still relatively, I mean, don't get me wrong, it's 2.5 times the gross receipts and almost 2 times the business activity tax, but it's still quite a low number. And I wondered if you could just talk through briefly what you premised that on. That was current structure and replacing the corporate minimums with just a percentage at every level or only at the top level?
This was just at every level. This is the simple perspective where the minimum tax is just 0.7% of sales. So the current 12 steps would be gone, would be replaced by this flat percentage. So the idea here is with the corporate income tax, they make two calculations. One would be 0.7% of their Oregon sales, and then they would calculate their tax under their current rates. And so with the 0.7%, it moves a lot of people from a lot of corporations from paying under the rates to paying under the minimum tax.
Interesting. And that follow up. Mm-hmm. And then you did not, so you didn't use the, you didn't involve the corporate elimination because you couldn't, because it still needs, okay, sorry. I'm just going to retract. Can I retract that beginning of a question, please?
I have to retract.
Yeah. Okay. And, okay, no, I lied. I thought of another one. So right now, what is, so the minimum, I know it's an amount per, on the 12 steps, what is about, is there an approximate percentage? I know I've done it before when I've been looking at it, but.
I believe, well, it's
hard to calculate that way.
Because it's a dollar amount, and there are blocks there. It ranges from $150 to $100,000.
Okay.
So the actual rate, and I've actually even created this chart, and it's a mountain range kind of thing, but 0.1%. But then it decreases once you get to that top step, where the minimum tax is $100,000, and then it just goes down.
How much you, okay, great, thank you.
Senator Burdick, Senator Bentz, any reactions to this part of the presentation?
Chris, what were the primary arguments used against the gross receipts tax when it failed, when it went in front of the voters? Was it stacking, pyramiding? What was the, had about 5 different reasons that it was a bad tax. I've forgotten most of them. Can you recall? Pyramiding was one. Can you explain?
Too high a rate.
Pyramiding.
It was just too high a rate.
Oh, from the measure a couple years ago?
Yes.
Well, there the rate was, it was a gross receipts rate of 2.5%. So that is much larger than some of the rates. So that's part of it. And it was just on corporations that had Oregon sales of at least $25 million.
But tell me about pyramiding, as I've forgotten. You mentioned it briefly in one of our previous meetings.
The idea there is through either the supply chain or the production chain, as basically businesses sell the businesses. If a business is subject to the gross receipts tax, then they will pay that tax, and then it gets built into the costs that they are then charging the business when they sell their products to. So business one sells their products to business two because business two uses it as an input. And if the argument for the pyramiding is that 0.2% or whatever is added on to that part that business one sells to business two, and then when business two sells to the consumer, it's an additive effect. And that's basically what the pyramiding is.
Right. And it seems to me that the business activities tax was less subject to that, and that was because we backed out cost of goods.
That's the big reason. You subtract cost of goods sold, and that's where you're getting to a value-added tax, where the value-added is based on the I'm trying not to just say value-added again. It's the cost of labor and capital. So, for example, the New Hampshire tax, it's an additive approach where you add three components: your cost of labor, your compensation, interest payments, and dividend payments. Where the labor payments are what your two, from an economics perspective, there are two factors of production really: labor and capital, and then you have some natural resources. But the labor compensation, that's the cost of labor, and then the cost of capital is the interest and dividends that the company pays. And when you're taxing those, when company two takes their input from company one and they do something to it, when they're doing something to it, that's when they're paying labor or they're using the cost of capital to add value to that product or service, and then when they sell it. So that's how you get it, of backing out the pyramiding.
Follow up, Madam Chair. The Paul Warner had he always resorted back to a reason why a VAT would be bad in Oregon, but I've forgotten that also. He just instantly would say, no, you want to do that because, can you fill in the blank for me?
Yeah, a VAT is used generally at the national level. When you get it to a subnational level, it gets a little bit tricky about where some of the factors are located. And even some of the states that have implemented that, like the Michigan single business tax, they will then apportion it via sales. They try to compensate for that, for those difficulties.
Okay, that doesn't sound quite like what he said, but it's been some years ago since we discussed it.
There might be some, I'll do a little bit of digging, but there might be some.
It had something to do with the point of sale. That's what I recall. Or one of the different interesting things we've done in this state that made that particular tax undesirable.
Part might be getting at the destination base versus.
I think that was it.
And so when you go with the gross receipts, you're focusing on Oregon sales. And then with a value added, you're kind of mixing up whether the sale is going to Oregon or exporters. And so it's a disincentive to the exporting. And under this, in a subnational economy, there's a lot of exporting to other states that's not the international exporting. So that's a little bit different. So that could be what he was referring to.
Exactly what it was. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, thank you.
Yes,
Chair. Senator Benz brought up the ballot measure 97. I was one of those strongly opposing it because the rate was so high, almost 10 times higher than Ohio, and because of the pyramiding. And I learned a lot about pyramiding during that. And then in 2017, when we looked at this, and I talked to people in Ohio, and I said, well, what about pyramiding? And they said, well, one way to really mitigate pyramiding is to keep your rate really, really low. And then it just is almost non-existent. And so there's this 0.28, 0.26?
26,
yeah.
And your 0.33 for a gross receipts tax is based, what's the threshold of people who pay it? Is there a threshold?
This was very basic in terms of just applying it to everything.
Everybody, yeah. And that was the other problem with 97, is it had a pretty high threshold.
And the other thing to keep in mind about the pyramiding is under a gross receipts, a destination based, all of these sales have to be in Oregon.
Yes.
If I recall correctly, and I'm sure I do, the primary argument against it was not technically correct, is that the gross receipts tax was a sales tax, when in point of fact it isn't. But perhaps you could explain that also, why? Yeah.
Well, economists generally view these as consumption taxes. So the most common consumption tax is a retail sales tax. So you buy something at the store and you get your receipt and you can see the tax that you have to pay. So that's a consumption tax. The gross receipts is also viewed from an economic theory standpoint, a tax on consumption, because something has to be sold, and then the tax, that's what triggers the tax. The difference there is on legal incidence of the tax. And so under a gross receipts tax, it's the businesses that pay the tax. So they'll file their annual return or make quarterly or monthly payments, depending on how the administrative aspects are set up. But they make those payments to the state on all of their gross sales, you know, setting aside whatever exemptions or thresholds might be there.
I can't believe that.
But from that side, we get to that. I think you're getting at the consumption piece.
Yeah. In the follow-up, Madam Chair.
Yes.
The consumption piece here would be replacing a production piece if the corporate tax was repealed. So is that what, when it says, I'm sorry, you have personal income tax here, and then you have corporate income tax elimination. Mm-hmm. The question is, when you run the OTIM report, you're replacing a production tax with a consumption tax, and that should give you a kick. Is that true?
I guess I wouldn't necessarily refer to it as a production tax, because it's kind of a net profits tax, the income tax.
On?
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Well,
but
okay.
I'm not trying to be.
Yeah, I get it. But the question is that going to help the economy or hurt it when it comes to the production side of our economy?
Yeah, well, there are a couple aspects there. One is there's a stability aspect to the consumption tax versus the profits tax. And I think that does offset some of the impacts. I mean, and if we get to it, we can talk about some of the OTIM runs and the impacts in those models.
So I'm more interested in the economic impact, not the happiness of government. So the question is, So will the OTIM model reflect, answer the question I ask?
It attempts to, yeah.
It attempts to do it.
Yeah.
Hmm.
I have a question about, I know that probably two of our members would like to leave by 6 because of weather concerns. I have a question for Mr. Alanak. There's an exhibit, it's the second one, that Representative Smith Warner is unable to.
It just came up finally.
Oh, you finally got it. I was going to ask you to please display it on the screen so we could all see it and have an opportunity to ask a question about it if there are questions. Could you tell us what we're looking at here?
Sure. This chart is taken from information. Also in OLIS, there's a report on business taxes that's put out regularly by cost. And in one of those tables there, they provide a calculation where it's total business taxes as a share of private sector GDP, and they present it in a table form. And I've just taken that, so it's kind of an effective tax rate for all business taxes that the different states levy on or impose on businesses, sales taxes, property taxes, licenses and fees, to get at simply a business taxes as a share of private sector GDP. And so, taken from that report, that average share is about 4.5%, and that's in the middle of the chart there in the red bar, and that's the U.S. average. And across the states, this percentage ranges from about 3.5% for Missouri and Indiana up to a top of about 7.5% for Vermont. And Oregon is 6th or 7th lowest at about 3.7%.
So is this synonymous with the business tax burden in state and local taxes?
They go through and estimate the all of the business taxes, including the business taxes paid through the personal income tax, and you take that total business tax burden and divide it by the state's GDP, so they kind of normalize it in those percentage terms.
So the average is about
4.5,
and Oregon's down at
3.7, I think.
3.7, below the national average.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Two quick questions. One, I've heard you say GDP, gross domestic product, but I see GSP. Is that just a typo?
Gross state product.
Perfect. Okay, thank you.
I've been doing this long enough that when they switched to gross state, it used to be state GDP. They switched the terminology, so I apologize.
No. I just learned something, so that's wonderful.
Same question.
We'll catch up.
The second question, when it shows Oregon in its current position there, is that all-inclusive, including property taxes as well?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, they've been producing this report since maybe 2003, either on an annual or every other year basis. And they've modified their method to try and include all taxes that businesses pay.
Thank you.
And then, thank you, Madam Chair. I know this is there are many different ways to rank these numbers. I've seen a variety of them. But this is a way, could we run a simulation as to getting to, let me pull up the other thing with the principles. Senator Bence's comment about, or no, sorry, Senator Burdick's about kind of where this would put us in line with other states as well. Is this something we could theorize, like we could take proposals and see how it would move us in these? I guess we'd have to, I mean, clearly it would be an estimate, but all of this is.
Should be able to do that.
Okay.
I'd have to hold all of the other states constant, but yeah, right. Basically take the Oregon number and add something to it and then Let's find out what that does to the rankings.
So that's one of the ways we can do that as a way to look at that consideration. Well, not a principle, a consideration. And then also, I'm also always interested to look at these because if you take out sales taxes, that moves us as well to kind of, it's a little bit of a yin and yang of, on the one hand, well, if you take out sales taxes, we move up in the rankings. But on the other hand, that's for a ranking point, but businesses still don't pay sales taxes. So they're still just playing the reality of, yes, it includes sales tax, which we don't do. But on the other hand, that's a business expense that businesses here don't have. So,
correct, and that's part of the ranking here. There are a lot of things that go into that, but Vermont, for example, collects a lot of property taxes, mm-hmm. and businesses pay a lot of property taxes, so they're going to show up at a higher end here. Mm-hmm. So it does reflect the mix of taxes as they vary across the states.
And I just have to say, knowing that Massachusetts has very high per pupil funding for their education and very good results commensurate with that, this would make me think they must have higher personal income taxes since they are relatively low on the corporate side on this.
Sales tax.
Oh, and sales tax, thank you. Right, okay.
Madam Chair, we've seen the charts a lot, I think, in our revenue committees about when you look at the corporate income tax, Oregon is down typically 47, 48, and the business community says, well, that's not really fair because a lot of taxes paid by business are through S-Corps and in their own personal income taxes. But you're saying this chart incorporates those into this still, even with those in there, we're this far below average.
Yeah, they've taken, I'm not sure, I can't recall at the moment the exact, the answer is yes. They have a method where they try to include the personal income taxes paid by businesses, so there has to be entities.
Mm-hmm. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Just sharing a personal experience. About 5 years ago, I had a chance to do a lot of work in Wyoming and North Dakota, working on coal and oil projects. And they actually have a pretty aggressive taxation system on their natural resources. But with that said, they also have gold-plated educational systems in Wyoming at the time. And again, this is personal experience, nothing scientific. At the time, when I was meeting with their legislature, they had a plan within 10 years to replace every one of their public institutions, educational institutions, from elementary to high school. And so when you see that rate of taxation, they were taking their resources and putting it right back into their K through community college level system. Mm-hmm. Again, that's just a personal experience, a personal observation.
Thank you. There is another document that has been provided to us. It's available on OTIS. OLS, and I was looking just now at it. It's how many pages long? Oh my gosh. It's the document called Business Tax Study, and it has a lot of detail in there, about 28 pages maybe or so. And I hope that we have an opportunity to glance through it and pick out those pages that might add a little more detail to answer our questions about what's included and how the states are compared to one another, so that you can see what they're including, how they're analyzing it. Any other comments about that last chart we were looking at, comparing? Yes, Senator Benson.
Thank you, I'm sure. Just to, and Chris, again, forgive me, that 1 year of not being on this committee has caused me to forget all things revenue related. But the question is this: we talked at length about the comparison between Oregon systems and Washington states, and we talked much about the value of Oregon's approach for new businesses, and then when they reached a certain point, they all picked up and left and moved to other states for reasons having many, many times with our income tax structure and middle management, difficulty in keeping middle management around here. But I don't recall if there was any linkage between our corporate tax rate and the fact that we were having to pay more to keep people around because of the higher income tax hit. And I'm relatively sure that's small and true in smaller corporations. I do not know about larger. Do we have studies that because that is a deceptive chart we just looked at, unless you take into account other tax challenges we face here in Oregon. So is there such a study? Is there such a link?
I will have, a study doesn't come to mind immediately, but I have heard repeatedly anecdotal information around some kind of, when talking about business location decisions, and the personal income tax comes into play because, well, what will be the personal tax burden of the officers of the company and upper management of a company coming into play? And I think that's kind of what you're getting at. And that's how the personal income tax can have an impact on business location decisions.
And the obvious follow-up is, if a part of this program was designed to drive down that income tax problem, then business might be more enthusiastic about this redesign of our system. And I say might be because don't know without a study.
And that was included in, there were various plans that were discussed in 2017, and some of the options included reductions in the personal income tax for those reasons.
Right.
Senator Hess.
Well, I'm curious, Senator Benz, you say this is deceptive. Basis.
Thank you for the question. Well, so it's understated in that it doesn't take into account the point I just raised. In other words, you note that there's a lower income tax here, but there's a much higher, corporate tax here, but there's a much higher personal income tax here. So you can't look at that column without asking yourself, gee, why would that be? And so you can't view that column in a vacuum. You've got to, that's why I said earlier, you got to look at the rest of the tax burden on any business and decide what's really going on. Mm-hmm. And I'm not suggesting, because I wasn't here, well, actually I was, what was discussed when the corporate tax was last increased. I don't know if people sat around and said, gee, I wonder what this will do to our competitive posture when we also take into account the one of the top income taxes in the nation. So that's why I say it's doesn't tell you the whole story, which is true for almost every chart.
Well, I don't disagree with that, but I my understanding, Chris, is this does have baked into it the S-corp and personal income taxes that businesses pay through their personal income tax. Yes?
The pass-through.
Right. It's the pass-through income for the business holders, but it doesn't include the income tax on employees. So it's the owners of the business. So it's their share of the personal income tax. But not the household tax version of the personal income tax.
Sure.
And I would just say, while that's true, I don't I mean, that's a whole different conversation. I mean, you could say that, I mean, if the idea is we're trying to get a sense broadly across the spectrum of where we are in business taxes, sure, that's another thing. Well, yes, and they all have different and all those states have different personal income tax structures and sales taxes and not sales taxes. So, I mean, you could also come right back and say, yeah, but that doesn't take into account the fact that we don't have a sales tax here. And so people here, they pay higher personal income tax, but they don't pay sales tax on anything they buy either. So I would just say, acknowledge that. And at the same time, we have to come to an agreement that that is a decent equivalency of business tax burden, period. And while that is a thing that's not taken into account, it's not supposed to. That's supposed to be about trying to come up with some equalization of business tax burden.
I have been interested in the past to see the chart that illustrates exactly what you're talking about, the total tax burden. And Oregon, the last few times I looked, we were in the bottom third of the states for total tax burden, all state and local taxes, which includes personal. So that is, speaking to your point, if we're at some point, if we're looking at, but what does this do to our total tax burden? There has been some outside third-party independent analysis comparing the states. Is it Cost that did that one too?
Yeah, I believe.
We should find that. Senator?
Your point is, the last two points are both interesting. I would simply say that you cannot measure Oregon's position simply against the other states without looking at, let's say, per capita income in Oregon. And I recall really clearly from a number of years ago how pathetic Oregon looked as compared to other states around it when it came to per capita income. So now, hopefully, over the past 8 years since I saw that chart, things have improved. I do remember the economist coming in, and I asked him, what could we do to change this picture? And he goes, nothing. And that was a very disturbing answer. As far as viewing these charts in a vacuum, we can't. So just saying, when I call out the inadequacy of a chart, it's in the context of the broader conversation we must have if this is going to happen without being taken away by the people. So we have to take into account every aspect of tax when we talk about it, not just whatever we'd like to narrowly view. So forgive me for being direct, but that chart does not tell the whole story in the context of this committee. So now I can sit here and have people remark upon the inadequacy of my analysis, but I'm going to not take it. So just so you know, I'm happy to be here, happy to be part of this discussion, but I want to keep this up at a pretty high level. And so if to the extent that that doesn't happen, I'm going to call you out. Is that clear?
And right back at you, sir.
We understand each other.
We sure do.
I'm glad you're at that end.
Next time I'll be right next to you. Mm.
Are there any other questions or comments on this particular chart? Senator Hass, you're one of the members of this subcommittee who was hoping that we could leave early due to weather issues. Is this a good stopping point for you?
Decent stop.
Okay. Anything else that you want to discuss tonight before we adjourn? Next time, Senator Hass, do you anticipate we'll use the full 2 hours at our next subcommittee meeting?
I don't know. It feels like we're at the end of the day here, and between an hour and 2 hours feels like
about right.
About right. Yeah.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I'm going to bring in some other thoughts on those principles, because I think it's worthy of making sure we have good, clear goals as we're going forward. And it may be that they'll be very modest, but it kind of depends on the amount of time available to think about it. Pretty okay. Important issues.
Yep. Good.
And while I'm on that point, I noticed that you added in, Chris, at the end, some suggestions regarding offsets. And in other words, and I was interested in why you did that, whether, you know, what the purpose of that was. Is that a principle that we're supposed to be thinking about, that whatever we do here is going to involve an offset of another tax, or is that merely for illustrative purposes?
Can I take a swing at that? my intent is to have a personal tax reduction for two reasons. I don't want, well, I just want to do that. But also, I think from a policy standpoint, we need to keep people whole from a tax like this, because much of it will be passed on. So if we reduce their personal tax load, that will protect them from whatever pass-through that the modeling will show. But that's been my, that was baked into our models in 2017, and it's been my intent the whole time. And I don't think there's any, I don't think there's anybody who argues with that, with not including that.
But I'm happy to hear that.
Yeah. And there's 1,000 different ways to do it. That'll be the hard thing, is where you do it, how much, you know, standard, you know, add to the standard deduction, go across all rates, one rate, two rates, and how far.
Well, it leads us into the concept of this committee being a tax reform committee as opposed to merely go find more money committee.
I absolutely agree with that one.
Thank you.
Nope. Anything else?
I appreciate you saying that.
Anything else for tonight? And you might bring something to us on Thursday night when we meet.
Yeah, I will. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Smith. We're adjourned.